Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Daled Amud Aleph. The Gemara is continuing the discussion from the end of yesterday's daf, where Rish Lakish posed the question of Yochanan with regards to the restriction of Lotit Kodudu. Lotasu Agudot Agudot, that Bnei Yisrael should not become factionalized. Rish Lakish was bothered by the opening Mishnah in Masechet Megillah, which lays out different times for individuals to discharge the obligation with regards to Megillah. That is that the Bnei Kfarim, the villagers, read on the Yemei Aknisa, 11, 12, 13th, or 14th. The Bnei Ayarot, the unwalled cities, read on the 14th. And the Bnei Akrachim, the walled cities, read it on the 15th. And that seems to be a classic problem of lo tasu agudot agudot, that there are different halachic streams for different parties. Seems to be a divisive type of halacha. And how come that is not a violation of lo titkodudu? So Rabbi Yochanan responds and says, well, we find other examples of different practices, and maybe different practices aren't considered to be a problem of lo titkodudu. And he quotes from the Mishnah in Makom Shenagu in Masechet Pesachim, whereby there are different practices on the morning of Erev Pesach as to whether there's a restriction against doing malacha or not doing malacha. To that, Reish Lakish responded, there's a difference between minhag, which is what you're speaking about, and isur, which is what I'm speaking about. So Rabbi Yochanan then continues and says, well, in Makom Shenagu, there in the fourth parak, it also brings up a machloke between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai with regards to isur malacha on the night of Bedikat Chameit, as to whether there is a restriction or not, and the language they're used is it asur or mutar? So there you see isur and heter with regards to it, even though it's a din or a minhag. Rish Lakish once again responds there to Rabbi Yochanan and says it's different, because with regards to that question about doing work or not doing work, one can be stringent and still not be in violation of the parties that say that you're allowed to do work, because people can be unemployed. They could have nothing to do. There are other reasons why people would desist from work besides a religious obligation. Therefore, to be machmir or stringent in those cases isn't necessarily acting in a manner that makes you different than the parties that are there, as opposed to the case of the Megillah, where it's clear that these parties are taking differentiated approaches to when they're going to read the Megillah, and they have separate dinim completely. So this is why this Gemara is brought over here, because then the Gemara moves to our Mishnah, which says that Beit Shammai is matir the tzarot, and Beit Hillel is oser the tzarot to the achim. And the Mishnah seems to indicate that each one of them kept their own practices, but they did not desist from marrying into each other. So if that's the case, we see that they have differentiated opinions with regards to Isser and Heter, and they kept separate practices. So that which the Gemara answers, Misavarat Asu Beit Shammai Kedivrahim. Did you really think that Beit Shammai acted on their Psak Halacha? Lo Asu Beit Shammai Kedivrahim. That was their theoretical position, but then they adhered to the position of Beit Hillel based on the fact that the Halacha is like Beit Hillel. That's the view of Reish Lakish. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan Amar Asu Vasu. That's not true. And supporting his contention that this isn't the problem, Rabbi Yochanan believes that Beit Shammai did act according to their position. Ubeplugto de Rabbi Shmuel. And this aligns with another machloka that we have between Rabbi Shmuel. The Rabbi Omer lo asu Beit Shammai kedivrehem. It was a theoretical position that Beit Shammai took, but they did not act on that position. Shmuel Amar asu vasu. And Shmuel says that they did act on that position, and therefore Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan align in their positions, whereas Rav and Reish Lakish align with their positions. So, Amat, when did this take place? Where does this discussion about whether Beit Shammai acted in accordance with their position or deferred to Beit Hillel? Ilei Makodim Batkol, if it was before the heavenly voice came out and said that the Halacha is like Kedivrei Beit Hillel, this is a story the Gemara tells in the Gemara in Eruvin with regards to the machloket between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And the end, the Batkol comes out and says, Halacha is kedivrei Beit Hillel. So if it was before the heavenly voice emerged, my time of the mandamar lo asu. Then what's the reasoning behind the person that says that Beit Shammai did not follow their position? Meaning that if there was yet to be a hachra'ah, decisive decision with regards to this matter, why wouldn't Beit Shammai act according to their view? Velel achar batkol. So you're going to tell me, okay, it was after the heavenly voice appeared? My time of demand amar asu. Then what's the reason behind the parties that say that they acted on their position? After the heavenly voice comes down and says the halacha is like Beit Hillel, why are Beit Shammai continuing to act in accordance with their position, which is at odds with the batkol? My answer is there are two possibilities. Ibaitema kodem batkol. Some say it was before the heavenly voice. Ibaitema lachar batkol. Some say it was after the heavenly voice. Ibaitema kodem batkol. It was before the heavenly voice emerged. Ukagon de Beit Hillel Ruba, because Beit Hillel was still the majority in that situation. And therefore, even in regular normative halachic decisions, we would follow the majority. And Beit Hillel is the majority. So the mandamar lo asu, daha Beit Hillel Ruba. So then we would understand why Beit Shammai only kept their position theoretically, but did not act on their position. That is because Beit Hillel was the rove, and therefore the halacha was going to follow the position of Beit Hillel. Manda Mar Su, wait a minute, but what about the side that says that they did act on their position? Ki Azlan and Bita Aruba, when do we follow the majority? Hechadicha Dodi Ninu, that's only when they are peers, when they are equals that are arguing. Hacha Beit Shammai Mechadadei Tefei. But over here, Beit Shammai was much sharper. They were more erudite. And maybe in that case, we would follow that position despite the fact that Beit Hillel was the majority. And therefore, the machloket was, who was the halacha like? Was it like Beit Hillel, who were the rov? Was it like Beit Shammai, who were the sharper and more erudite? And that was the machloket as to whether Beit Shammai should act on their position or not act on that position. So that would be the way to explain the machloket prior to the emergence of the bat kol, the heavenly voice that said the halacha is like Beit Hillel. The other option is, ibaitem alachar bat kol, happened after the heavenly voice emerged. Mandam arlo asu, according to the ones who say that they didn't act on their position, Tanafka Batkol. That's because the heavenly voice emerged and said the law is like Beit Hillel. Why would Beit Shammai then continue to act in accordance with their position if they got a voice from the heavens that tells them that they're wrong? But what about the one who says that they continue to act on their position? Rabbi Yoshua, it's like Rabbi Yoshua, the Amar in Mashkechim Bevatkol, says that we don't listen to heavenly voices. So this is based on the Gemara in Bava Metzia with regards to Rabbi Eliezer and Tanur Shelachnai. Over there, the machlok between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim as to whether Tanur Shelachnai is Tahor or Tameh. And there, Rabbi Eliezer calls for a heavenly voice to back him up. And sure enough, the heavenly voice comes and backs him up. And Rabbi Yeshua says, we don't listen to heavenly voices. He marshals the famous line, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, that with regards to halachic matters, that's not a matter of heaven, that's decided down on earth, and that we're not going to listen to the bat kol. Now, Tosafot over here already asks, how do we know that that's Rabbi Yeshua's position in general? Maybe that was particular to the case of Rabbi Eliezer, because over there, the bat kol came down only because Rabbi Eliezer requested it, maybe because it was bichvodo for the kavod of Rabbi Eliezer, therefore we don't listen to it, but maybe in general, he would be willing to accept the decision or the information that's offered by a bat kol. Or because over there, by the bat kol of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer was arguing on the Chachamim, and he was in the minority. So maybe that's why Rabbi Yeshua rejects it over there. So Tosafot says that the fact that Rabbi Yeshua doesn't simply say, we're not going to listen to the bat kol, but rather he gives a principle by which he's indicating why we don't listen to the bat kol, which is Lo B'Shamayim Hi, that has broad application, and therefore his position is that we don't listen to a bat kol in any situation. Despite that fact, over here by Beit Hillel, we do listen to the bat kol, and Tosafot differentiates because, again, either there, the bat kol was Rabbi Lezer's kavod, or because Rabbi Lezer was in the minority, as opposed to Beit Hillel, where it came out, even though they didn't request it, and it was that they were the majority, and therefore the bat kol was supporting what would otherwise have been the normative decision anyway. And therefore, that helps to explain why we would or wouldn't listen to a bat kol in these different cases, which is in the end that the bat kol is not the decisive factor, it is the fact that Beit Hillel was the majority. So now the Gemara goes back to our situation and says, okay, based on the fact that we have this distinction in the positions of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, and according to Manda Amar Asu, and according to those that think that the Beit Shammai did act on their position, and Tosafot also points out that it's obvious that Beit Shammai acts according to their position because we have other cases in Shas, including Rabbi Tarfon in the first parak in Brachot, who lays down to say Kriyat Shema, and the Chachamim say that you were deserving of death because you followed the position of Beit Shammai in the face of Beit Hillel and endangered yourself when that wasn't necessary, it wasn't a proper way to act, as well as the fact that we saw in the Gemara in Beitza that when Hillel brought the Korban on Yom Tov, that the Talmidei Beit Shammai started to heckle him and give him a hard time about it. So we know that Beit Shammai did practice like that, and so Tosafot says, we'll see from many other cases that the Gemara brings, and they sufficiently prove that they did act on their position. Therefore, the Gemara doesn't have to bring all of these other cases, because it'll become obvious that that is the case. So the Gemara says, Umanda Marasu, Karinan Kan Lo Titko Dudu. What do you do with Lo Titko Dudu? According to the one who said Beit Shammai did actually act on their position, it wasn't a theoretical position. Or in essence, how do we deal with this problem that a Rish Lakish raised to Rabbi Yochanan of having multiple dinim that are now normative halacha within Klal Yisrael? So the Gemara says, how do we deal with Lo Titko Dudu, Lo Tasu Agudot, Amar Abaye? So the first solution is brought by Abaye, which is Kamrina Lo Titko Dudu, Kon Shtei Batei Dinim, Bir Achat. That's only when there's two different courts that are paskening halacha or differentiated halacha in the same city. Halalo Morim Kedivrei Beit Shammai, Halalo Morim Kedivrei Beit Hillel. It's one court or one stream or one faction in the city follows the position of Beit Shammai, and the other faction in the city follows that of Beit Hillel. That's problematic. That's lo tilgodudu. But if you have two courts in two different cities, then we don't worry about it. Or in essence, what Abaye says is that there is some sort of boundary in which we want there to be unification and to have a singular halachic sock that everybody follows. So Abaye says that region is a city. It has to be some sort of natural demarcation based on the way that the population is laid out or the way that people are grouped, and therefore cities are central places or areas where we'd expect people to act and follow the same rules. And therefore in that area, if they follow the same rules, then it's not a problem with what to do. Two different cities have different rules. That's fine because we already consider them to be separate enough entities that they're not really clashing in the issue of lo tikudodudu. We see that as being different practices rather than an inconsistency in the practice in a singular area, which we'll come back to discuss in a minute what exactly is the problem of lo tikudodudu. So amalei rova va beit shemai beit hillel kishtei batei dininim ba'ayir achad dami. Wait a minute, beit shemai and beit hillel are the equivalent of two courts in a single city. And that is because maybe beit shemai and beit hillel transcend the boundaries of cities. Not like Rav and Shmuel, where Rav is in Sura and Shmuel is in Narda, where they're associated with a particular city or they're more the adra of a city. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, again, transcended cities. Their machlok was much broader in Klal Yisrael. So to say that if a city passes like Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, that's not somehow in discord or inconsistent with having them some other city paskin like the other party, that's not true because they are bigger than any given city. And therefore, how could you make that claim? El Amar Rava, so Rava suggests, Ki Amin and Lotit Godudu. Lotit Godudu is Kigon Beitin Bi'ir Achat. It's when a single halachic authority in a city, Peleg Morim Kedivrei Beit Shammai, half of them or a portion of them passing like Beit Shammai, Upeleg Morim Kedivrei Beit Hillel. It's only when you have an inconsistency in a single halachic entity where we consider that to be a problem of Lotit Godudu. But if you have two separate courts or two separate halachic authorities, be'ir achat, even in a single city, leit lamba, we don't have any problem with that. Abaye sees the threshold of lo tikudodudu being citywide, meaning based on not the halachic authority or entity, but rather on the boundaries of a natural region or population, which is bound by something like a city. And therefore, the cities should have a consistent halachic practice. The other hand, Rava focuses on the halachic authority that's granting the psak halacha. And therefore, within that halachic authority, there needs to be consistency. There can't be inconsistency in the singular or in that particular halachic authority. But even if there are multiple halachic authorities in a single city, that's fine because each halachic authority is at least consistent in their psak, and that's not problematic. But Tosfot asks a very difficult question, which is, how does this answer the problem that we raised in the beginning with regards to Megillah? With regards to Megillah, that's even in a singular city, we're going to have differentiated practices. And that is because the villagers come into the city, and then one of the city people reads the Megillah on behalf of those villagers that are coming in on an alternate day from the 14th when the people of the city are going to read it. And that's exactly what we just said is problematic, at least according to Abaye, for sure it's problematic because it's a singular city with multiple practices now. And that is cause a problem of lo tikudodudu according to Abaye. As Rashi says on the first daf in Megillah, it's because the Bnei HaKfarim don't know how to read the Megillah for themselves. And even according to Rava, it might be problematic because of the fact that you now have a single authority in a city or the Bnei Ayir reading for some people on the Yemei Knesset, reading for some people on the 14th. It might even be classified as a single authority having two different outcomes or two different Pesukei Halacha. Therefore, Tosafot says, Abaye and Rava's solutions might be good for some of these cases, but it still doesn't solve the problem of Kriyat HaMegillah. So to hear the Rishonim have multiple answers about how to deal with this, the Rosh over here indicates that the assumption that you had here, based on that Rashi in the beginning of Masechet Megillah, is that one of the city dwellers is the one who read for the villagers. That may not be true. It actually might be that it has to be one of the villagers that reads for the villagers themselves. And Tosafot actually backs that position based on the Yushami, which says that a person who lives in a unwalled city can't read for someone who's in a walled city, and someone in a walled city can't read for someone who is in a unwalled city. And therefore, also too over here, it should be the same thing, that the Bnei Ha'ir should not be able to read for the Bnei Ha'Kfarim, and the Bnei Ha'Kfarim should not be able to read Bnei Ha'ir, which means that the Bnei Ha'Kfarim read for themselves, and therefore it wasn't an issue of Lo Tidkodudu. Now that might answer the question with regards to Rava, because then you can keep the stream separate, which is that the villagers did their thing and the people of the city did their thing, but it still doesn't solve your problem with regards to Abaye. So the Tosfot himself over here quotes from the Rabbeinu Chaim HaKohen, who suggests that the Bnei Ha'Kfarim did not read in the cities, but rather the Bnei Ha'Kfarim, the villagers, actually read in their villages. And that's why it had to be that a villager read for the villagers, because they were reading in their own cities. And then that would solve the problem even according to Abaye, because the villagers would do their thing in their own village, and the city people do their own thing in their cities. And therefore, you would not have a problem of two different streams within a single city. Much of this goes back to the discussion in the Gemara Megillah as to what is the real reason for Yemei HaKnisa. Was it for the benefit of the villagers, or was it for the benefit of the city people? And why is it that we allow the villagers to read early? Some of those reasons might be influential in discussing what exactly was the practice of the villagers. Did they come into the city? Did they do it in the villages? Who read for them? All of that might be a part of this discussion with regards to how the Rishonim are answering this question that is raised by the Balei HaTosafot over here. And then the Rashba and the Ramban go on to suggest that maybe even if the villagers, the Bnei Ha'Kfarim, read in the city itself, they still would be classified as two different cities. And that's either because, as the Rashba says, they are visibly different, and you can tell someone who's a villager or a city dweller based on their clothing, their sophistication, the way that they act. Therefore, it was as if they were separate anywhere, two separate cities, even though they're both reading in the city itself. And the Ramban adds the possibility that they stayed in a specific part of the city. They weren't in the entire part of the city, so it was clear that they were separate. And therefore, it could be, even according to Abaye, considered to be two separate cities, even though both the villagers and the city people read in the city itself. The Rosh makes an interesting suggestion, which is that that's the halacha based on the Megillah. And that you can't call it Lo Tidkodudu if that's what the Megillah set out from the outset, that different places are going to have different dinim. But he then says that if you do say that, then Reish Lakish's question from the outset was a mistaken premise and a mistaken question. And that's maybe why Rabbi Yochanan didn't really treat Rabbi Reish Lakish's question with a seriousness and tried to dismiss it with the Mishnayot from Masechet Pesachim, because he didn't think it was an issue because the Megillah itself is the one that laid it out in that fashion. And then the Rashba brings the last possibility of his how to answer this question, which is that maybe the different question of the Gemara is not from the villagers, because the villagers is just a leniency that was instituted by the Chachamim based on the permission that's given by the Megillah that we learned in Masechet Megillah. And they don't have to read on the earlier day, but they have the opportunity or leniency to allow them to read on that day. The real problem of Lo Tidkodudu is how do you have it that on the 14th and the 15th there are two different dinim for different parties. And there you can answer like Abaye says over here, which is that it's two different cities. Over there, the unwalled cities read on the 14th, the walled cities read on the 15th, and they're separate places. And that's as if they're separate cities. It's not like the Bnei Ha'Kfarim coming into the cities where there's a mix between different parties with different practices. And therefore, the answer that Abaye gives actually addresses that issue. And therefore, the question really is why there's a difference between the 14th and the 15th. And then Abaye and Rava's answers do answer that question, because we're talking about different locations. And in different locations, there's no problem of Lo Tidkodudu. Now the Gemara moves on to discuss whether that's really true, that we don't have different practices amongst those people of Bnei Yisrael. Tashma, b'mkomosho Rabbi Eliezer, in the place of Rabbi Eliezer, who has a machloket Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara in Shabbat, Perek Rabbi Eliezer Demila, as to whether machshirei mitzvah are dochim at the Shabbat or not. Meaning, is it only things that are essential for the mitzvah itself that are doche Shabbat? That's the view of Rabbi Akiva. Anything that could have been done before Shabbat and wasn't done is not doche Shabbat. Anything that must be done on Shabbat is doche at Shabbat. Rabbi Eliezer says, even things that could have been done before Shabbat, makshirei milah, things that if you don't have a knife to do the brit milah, you can then make coals, you can bend metal, you can forge a knife in order to do this, because Rabbi Eliezer believes that even makshirei milah are doche et ha-Shabbat. And almost by definition, makshirei milah are going to be something that you could have done in Erev Shabbat, despite that fact Rabbi Eliezer thinks that you could do it. And so the Gemara says that in Rabbi Eliezer's city, they used to cut wood, chop down wood, lasot pachamim, to make coals, b'Shabbat, lasot barzel, in order to forge metal, in order to make the knife to do the brit milah on Shabbat. Tosafot points out that they did it intentionally, They used to put themselves in a position where they didn't prepare on Erev Shabbat so they could do it and show how much they loved the mitzvah and the fact that the mitzvah was Docha Shabbat, and they followed that position, Rabbi Eliezer. So in his city, they followed his psak. In the location of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, they used to eat chicken and milk together. That is because he believes that it says, and he learns from Bechalevi Mo, only a mammal that feeds their children through milk has a problem of being together with milk. And that's only Basar of Behema, or Basar Chaya, that's problematic to have together with Chalav. That's not true of Basar Of, because Of does not nurse, does not have milk, and therefore it wouldn't be a problem of Basar Of Bechalav. And in his city, they used to eat chicken and milk together. You see from this that this was the practice in the city of Rabbi Eliezer, but in the place of Rabbi Akiva, they used to follow the Shita of Rabbi Akiva. So now you have differentiated strains of halachic psak that are going on. The Tanya, Klala Amar Rabbi Akiva, anything you could have done before Shabbat is not overriding Shabbat, doesn't allow it to be done on Shabbat. Vai mai tuyufta. What type of question is this? We already answered this question. Mikomot, mikomot, shiny. It says specifically, in Rabbi Lazar's location they did this. In Rabbi Akiva's city they did this. So that's exactly what Abai said. In different cities you can have different practices. Udakarila, maikarila. And therefore, what was the questioner even thinking? Why is this even a question? Because of the stringency of Shabbat, we classify it as if it's one location. Meaning that since Shabbat is such a significant halacha, then we would consider all places in Klal Yisrael to be a single entity or a single place, and that's why we don't want anyone to violate Shabbat. We don't want anybody to have a dissenting opinion with regards to Shabbat, because Shabbat is so fundamental, integral to the faith, that we don't look at it as something that can be divided by cities, by something that is overarching principle of Klal Yisrael. Therefore, maybe it should be inappropriate that in the place of Rabbi Eliezer, they followed his opinion, despite the fact that we passed like Rabbi Akiva, and in the place of Rabbi Akiva, they passed otherwise. So, Kamash Balon, that we don't see that as being a problem of Lotit Kodudu, because they are in separate locations. So the question was, maybe Shabbat is a chad, how do we allow this? The answer is, that we allow it in separate places. Shabbat is no different than any other mitzvah. Tashma, the Rabbi Bau, ki ikla la'atre the Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, that Rabbi Abo, when he went to the city of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, he used to carry around a candle. When he went to the city of Rabbi Yochanan, he wouldn't carry around a candle. Now, obviously this cannot be a candle that's lit, because carrying around a candle that's lit on Shabbat is very problematic. This has to be a candle that was extinguished, but is muksa. And so Rashi over here says, Ner she likubo b'Shabbat. It happens to be a candle that was lit that Shabbat, b'kaba, and then it was extinguished or it blew out. And now he's carrying around, it's a muksa, a problem of muksa. The Savala Rabbi Yeshua ka Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi holds like Rabbi Shimon delayed lay muksa. And therefore, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, there's no din of muksa, and there's no problem to carry on the candle once it's blown out on Shabbat. And that's what Rabbi Bo did when he was in the city of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. As opposed to Rabbi Yochanan, who holds like Rabbi Yehuda, de'ilei muksa filu shlo machmat isur, even when it's not a muksa machmat isur. So what Tosafot points out over here, building on this Rashi, he says that it has to be a case that you lit the candle at that time, because Rabbi Yochanan, in the end of Perek Akira, and other places, paskins like Rabbi Shimon, with regards to muksa, machmat isur, and muksa, machmat miyus. So there are different types of muksa. One muksa is something that is because it's asur, it's muksa, because it does something, or its usage or utility on Shabbat is that of isur. Something is because it's disgusting. People don't carry it normally, they don't engage with it because it's something disgusting. So a ner has, and maybe both of those aspects. It has one aspect, which it's isur, it's used for something that is not allowed on Shabbat. And number two is it's maus, if it's klicheres, it has oil all over it, olive oil all over it, it's something that's disgusting. But Tosafot points out that Rabbi Yochanan believes that we hold like Rabbi Shimon with regards to that. And pasuk Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon, muksum machmat isur. Pasuk like muksum machmat isur is not a problem. And according to the Rabbeinu Tam, muksum machmat isur is even more problematic than muksum machmat miyus. Nevertheless, he paskin like Rabbi Shimon. So those can't be the problems here. So what is it that's bothering Rabbi Yochanan? The fact that it was lit on this Shabbat, and that's what Rashi points out, that it was lit this Shabbat, because that's doche b'yadayim. That's as if you pushed it out of being in the world of Shabbat. because you did an action that made it muksa. It's not simply that it was muksa. You did something that, like putting grugarot in simukim, which is putting in fruits to dry in the muksa, the place where they dry out, that's muksa b'yadayim, because there you specifically put them in a place where you have hesach hadat from them, where you're not intending to use them on Shabbat again. And there, many of the Amoraim believe that Rabbi Shimon agrees by grugarot and simukim that there is muksa. And similarly over here, when you light a candle going into Shabbat, that is being mesiach dat from it. You don't have any intent to use it on Shabbat or to take it on Shabbat. And therefore, even Rabbi Shimon would agree that it was a problem of muksa. And that's what the practice of Rabbi Yochanan was. And therefore, Rabbi Abou, when he went to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's city, he practiced like Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. And he carried around the candle that had extinguished. And when he went to the city of Rabbi Yochanan, he would not carry it around. V'hai mai, kushia. What a type of question is this? Why are you worried about him having these alternate practices? V'lo amrina mikomot mikomot shiny. Didn't we already explain that different locations are not problematic v'lo tidgodudu? So, ananachi kamrina, Rabbi Abou, echi avirocha. Our question is not about there were different practices according to Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon Levi in the different locations. Our problem is Rabbi Abou. V'echi avirocha hochi. How did he do this? Did it one place he acted like this and one place he acted like this? So Gemara says that's not a problem because Rabbi Abou, Rabbi Shimon ben Levi sphirle. Underlying Rabbi Abou believes of Rabbi Shimon ben Levi that it is mutter and that he paskin the kula. So if he paskin the kula, then to act as a machmir in another location is not a violation of what you think the loch is. If he really believed that the loch was like Rabbi Yochanan and it was a sword to carry it around and out of respect when he went to the city of Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, he was matir, that would be problematic because then he was clearly violating his personal view halachically. So what we have to say, and that's what the Gemara indicates over here, is that Rabbi Abou believes that the loch is like Rabbi Shimon Levi, that there is no muksa over here. And when he went to the city of Rabbi Yochanan, the chimakla adjei Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi metalto mishim kvodo de Rabbi Yochanan. When he went to see Rabbi Yochanan, even though he didn't believe that it was the loch, out of respect for Rabbi Yochanan, he adhered to the psak of Rabbi Yochanan in that city. The Tosafot over here says, why can't you say the same thing that Reish Lakish said in the end of yesterday's daf, which is that when you desist from doing something, it's no proof that you're disagreeing or changing the lacha, and maybe you just didn't need it. Maybe you didn't need to carry around a candle. So how do you know that when he's being machmir over here, that he's actually practicing like Rabbi Yochanan, and not simply not engaging in this halachic issue at all? So Tosafot says, because Rabbi Bob wouldn't even pick it up if the candlestick or the candelabra fell on his cloak or something that he needed, he wouldn't pick it up because of the muksa aspect of it. So that showed or that demonstrated that he was doing it because of halachic reason, not simply because he didn't need to do it. So there might be cases where he does need to do it and he still desisted from it. So it's clear he was doing it out of kavod for Rabbi Yochanan. But over here, it's not a problem because, again, first of all, it's two different cities. That's fine to have separate piskei halacha with regards to that. The problem is Rabbi Abou himself, how could he have an inconsistent practice? The answer to that is he has a consistent practice. He paskins the kula. He just, out of respect, deferred to Rabbi Yochanan when he went to the city of Rabbi Yochanan. By the way, this teaches us very basic derech eretz about this idea. It's important to have deference and kavod when you go into a place to act appropriately. Even though you might paskin the kula, even though you might not believe that this is the halacha, you should still, out of deference to those people, go ahead and follow the halacha or follow the practices that they have and not try to demonstrate that you don't have follow those positions or you don't act like they act. Here he did it out of respect for Rabbi Yochanan. He acted in according to the principles of Rabbi Yochanan. Rama says, "Vayika shama de modile vayaki shama." What about his shamish that came with him? How does he know what to do? Rama says, "The modile le shama." He told the shamish that he was doing this, or this was his practice. It's a little strange, this question of the Gemara. What about his shamish? Of course, his shamish knew what Rabbi Bo's practices were. Of course, Rabbi Bo taught him what to do. So, what's the nature of the Gemara's question over here? So, Rashi seems to be indicating something which the Ritva picks up on, which is that the shamash of Rabbi Abou would not focus on the fact that Rabbi Abou's practice here was different because of Rabbi Yochanan, and based on what he saw from Rabbi Abou in general, he would then follow the practice to carry it around because that's what he learned from Rabbi Abou. And so what the question of the Gemara is, why is it that Rabbi Abou wasn't more careful even outside of the city of Rabbi Yochanan to carry? If he wanted to have a consistent policy by which if he entered the city of Rabbi Yochanan, he would respect Rabbi Yochanan and follow his position, even outside the city of Rabbi Yochanan, he should have followed that position so those that were around him would learn from him and learn the right thing from him. So how could it be that he was doing this dual practice if other people could then learn from him and do the wrong thing? The grand answer is that he let them know why he was changing his practice, and therefore they were informed about it. Other Rishonim, like the Tosfot Rosh, the Tosfot Rishonim over here, and the Ritva also makes some comment like this, which suggests that if Lo Tidgodudu stops a person from having two different practices in a single location, it should also prohibit or stop someone, person, for having two different practices in two different places. Meaning that if the purpose of Lo Tidgodudu is to stop this factionalization, it should do it in two different areas. It should do it in a single location, shouldn't have two different practices. And a single person should also not have two different practices. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. How could it be that Rabbi Bo had two different practices? To which the Gemara answers, he didn't have two different practices. But then the Gemara says, well, how would the Shamash or the others know about that? The modile that he told them that they didn't have two different practices, his real practice was that the halacha was the kula, but he did that out of cover for Rabbi Yochanan, and that he didn't do it in the city of Rabbi Yochanan, but not that he had two different practices in two different cities. Now, the machloket here about explaining this Gemara also might be then touching on a deeper question as to what the problem or what the issue with Lo Tidgodudu is. Is the purpose of Lo Tidgodudu to prevent factionalization, to prevent discord amongst Bnei Yisrael, so that there should not be different, as we said, agudot, and therefore we're trying to create or coalesce around a single halacha? If that's the case, then the main focus of Lo Tidgodudu is going to be on the fact that different locations should not have multiple practices. We should have a consistency in locations, whatever you think that location is, whether you think it's based on the population, the citywide halacha, or whether you think it has to do with halachic authority that they have to be consistent. But either way, the focus is on the factionalization and keeping things consistent within the people in a certain area or a certain location or a certain region. On the other hand, if you believe that there might even be a problem to go to do if one person has multiple practices or different practices, that means that you're focusing on the fact that Lotid go to do makes the Torah into Skok V'Telula, which is that it makes it into like a joke. That you have the Torah and you have people changing their practices and bouncing around with their practices, that diminishes the Kavod HaTorah because it looks like you're taking inconsistent positions or that people play around with the halacha. And that might be the problem with Lo Tidgodudu. We don't want to make it look like the Torah has optionality in it. And that's the problem. And that might also be the machlok between Abai and Rava, that Abai thinks that the focus is on a single area because you want to keep a consistent policy and a consistent practice amongst the people. Whereas Rava might be focused on the issue of whether the Torah, it looks like a problem in terms of the Torah's kavod, when a single city has multiple practices, that's not a problem. But if you have a single halachic authority giving multiple answers or multiple practices out, that makes it look like it's a joke, or makes it look like the Torah has optionality in it, and that's not what we want. And maybe that is even the machlok that is between Abai and Rava as to what exactly the mitzvah of Lo Tidgodudu is. And that can be influential in how people understood what's the problem here with regards to Rabbi Bo's practice. Tashma, afal pish elu osrim ve'elu matirim. Back to our mission over here, which says that even though Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel had a differentiation in their opinions, and those were oser, and those were matir, lo nimne'u Beit Shammai melisa nashim mi'Beit Hillel ve'lo bitel mi'Beit Shammai. They did not desist from taking wives from each other. So, iamar bishlama lo asu. If you say that they did not act in accordance with their principles, Beit Shammai, there was a theoretical position, but everybody had paskin like Beit Hillel, then it makes sense that they did not desist from taking wives from each other because there was never a problem. Everybody was in the same boat or the same consistent halacha, and therefore there was no problem of arayot. If you believe that they really acted upon their positions, then amai lo nimnu. Why did they not desist from taking wives from each other? You have serious issues of arayot here. Bishlama Beit Shammai b'Beit Hillel lo nimnu. For Beit Shammai to take wives from Beit Hillel is not a big deal. Because according to the way that Beit Hillel paskins, in Beit Shammai's eyes, the only violation you have here is a violation of a lav. And that is because Beit Hillel believes that when you have a tzarat erva, that the erva dismissed without any questions because she's an erva, the tzarat erva also gets dismissed because the tzarat erva is released along with the erva itself. Now, Beit Shammai believes in that case that the tzarat erva needs chalitza. Now, if she doesn't get chalitza, then there's an isur lav, lo tiyeish demeita chutzal ish zar, that the woman who has a zikat yibum associated with her and needs to perform yibum or chalitza, she may not marry someone outside until chalitza or yibum is performed with her. And therefore, there's an isur lav that's involved. Now, an isur lav is problematic, but children born of that Isur Lav are still Ksherim, and they're not Psulim the Kuna. They're not problematic in terms of Arayot, they're not Mamzerim. And so therefore, of course, Beit Shammai could marry those children born, according to the Loch of Beit Hillel, who didn't have the Tzarat Erva do perform Chalitza, the only deficit would be an Isur Lav, and that would not be a problem for the people of Beit Shammai. A Beit Dilomi, Beit Shammai is a much more serious issue, because according to Beit Shammai, a Tzarat Erva could perform Yibum, which according to Beit Hillel, she's an Erva. She's an Isur Eshet Ach associated with her. Tzarat Erva, according to Beit Hillel, is just like the Erva itself, and she is dismissed or released without anything. And if you perform Yibum with her, you're in violation of a Chiyuv Karet of Eshet Ach, and the child born of that marriage is a Mamzer. So how could it be that Beit Hillel would marry those women of Beit Shammai if those women, according to Beit Shammai, were permitted to perform Yibum? And that would be an violation of the Isur Eshet Ach and produce Mamzerim. Amai lo nimnu. Then why didn't Beit Hillel desist from taking wives from Beit Shammai? B'nei chayvei karetot. The arayot that we're talking about here is subject to Echiyuv karet. It's an Isur Eshet Ach. And Mamzerim ninhu. And the product of that marriage are going to be Mamzerim. B'chitei makasabri Beit Hillel de'en Mamzer mechayvei karetot. If you want to suggest, okay, maybe Beit Hillel believes that Mamzerim only come from Chiyuvei mitat Beitin, not from Kretot. That's not true, because Hamar Rabbi Lozer, Afal Pi Shenechelku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel B'Tzarot, even though Beit Shammai Beit Hillel argue about whether a Tzarat Erva is released or not released, Modim Shein Mamzer El Mamish Sheisuro Isur Erva. They agree that the only way that you can produce a Mamzer is through an Isur Erva Vanush Karet. So we see that Beit Hillel agrees that Anush Karet is sufficient to create a Mamzer. So if you believe that Beit Shammai really acted on accordance with their position, how could it be that Beit Hillel was marrying women from the faction of Beit Shammai? The Lav Shvamina Lo Asu. The conclusion you must come from here is that Beit Shammai was stating a theoretical position but did not act according to that position. Where it says Lo Asu. No, they did act that way. The Modi Luhu Uparshe. Beit Shammai kept track of these women that had followed their halachic position. They used to warn the people of Beit Hillel, don't marry these women. We know according to you that these women are off limits to you, or these people are Mamzerim according to you. We'll keep them within the faction of Beit Shammai, who believes that these are fine. But they let them know. So they did act according to their position, but they were kind enough to then inform the other party. Once again, which shows this idea of tremendous kavod and respect for each other, that despite that they had differences in opinions, they were respectful of the other party's opinion. And they didn't cause the other party to violate their position. They were clear and conscientious of providing this information to the other party so there wouldn't be a problem. Tosfot over here says that the Gemara's solution or the Gemara's question seems strange because the Gemara is just asking about the offspring of these Tzarot Erva and to whether it was plausible that they could marry into the offspring of these Tzarot Erva, because according to Beit Hillel, in the eyes of Beit Shammai, there's an Isur Lav and so the children are not Mamzerim. And according to Beit Shammai's position, in the eyes of Beit Hillel, the children born of that Yibum are Mamzerim. Why don't we just worry about the women themselves? Meaning that according to Beit Shammai, the woman that Beit Hillel has released is now an Isur Lav, and therefore, if somebody from Beit Shammai marries that woman, they'll be in violation of a Lav. And on the other way around, if Tzarat Erevav, the woman fell to a brother who was from the faction of Beit Hillel, then it would be a problem of Isur Karet for this person from Beit Hillel. So why don't we discuss about the Tzarat Erva itself? So Tosfot makes an interesting point. He says, V'yesh lomar de tzara atzma lo shchicha kuli hai. Tzarot Erva are a very unusual case, and they are few and far between. On the other hand, children born of those marriages are going to be more plentiful, which means that for every Tzarat Erva, if there's offspring afterwards, then that is a multiplicative effect, which is that if you have 3, 4, 5, 6 children afterwards, then a single woman then creates 3, 4, 5, 6 problems for Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai, depending on whose position you are following. And therefore, the Gemara is focused on the offspring and not the Tzarot Erva themselves, which are much less of a problem. They are a problem, but they're just much less of a problem because of the infrequency of the occurrence. And the Gemara says, Hachanami Mistavro, it makes sense to say that Beit Shammai did follow their position, and they just informed the other party about it, the Tani Seifa, because the end of our Mishnah says, Kol Tarot V'chol Tameot Shehayu Eilu Mitarim V'Eilu Mitamin, when they had a machloket as to whether it was Torah Tamei, Lo Nimnu Osim Torot Eilu Al Gabi Eilu. They used to work together, or they used to lend out their kelim one to another, so they didn't worry about the fact that they had different views with regards to Tumah and Tara. Iyamart Bishlama Demoti Luhu, if you say that they informed them about this, Shumhochi lo nimnu. That makes sense why they did not desist from sharing things or working together. Iyamar delo modi luhu. But on the other hand, if you tell them that they did not inform them about this. They were not generous with this information and made it clear to the other party that this would be a problem for them. So Bishlama Beit Shammai Beit Hillel no linim nu. So this is the girsa of Rashi that we're following right now, which is Bishlama Beit Shammai Beit Hillel no linim nu. That Beit Shammai from Beit Hillel did not desist. The Tmeot to Beit Hillel, the Beit Shammai Tarot. Because Beit Hillel is the Chumrah and says things are Tmeim. And for Beit Shammai, they are Torim Ninhu. And so they didn't care about taking things from Beit Hillel. There was no downside for them. They thought things that Beit Hillel thinks are Tmei or Tahor. So Beit Hillel is more stringent than for Beit Shammai, who's the lenient opinion. Of course they can borrow or they can utilize those things at Beit Hillel. Elo Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, lama lo nimnu. But vice versa, it's problematic because Tarot to Beit Shammai, things that Beit Shammai think are Tahorim, the Beit Hillel are Tmeot. And therefore, how could Tmeot Ninhu? How could they ever borrow from things or utilize the things of Beit Shammai? Alav the Modi Luhu. Must be that they informed them. Shma Mina, that they definitely informed them, at least according to the one who says, Asu, that Beit Shammai acted according to their opinion. Rabbi says, Umay Ume Dahach Mehach. Why is the latter half of the Mishnah more compelling than the earlier part of the Mishnah? You have two parts of the Mishnah which say that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel did not desist from acting or intermingling, whether it was with regards to the Tzarot Erva, or whether it was with regards to Tuman Tahara. Why is Tuman Tahara better proof that they were Modi Luhu than the case of Tzarot Erva? So Madu Tema Tzara Kala Itlei. Maybe the reason that Tzarot Erva works is not because they were informing them, but because it's something that has a publicity associated with it. Having a Yabam, or having to do the, perform the Yibum or the Chalitza is a very public event. It's something that's well known, and therefore parties would know about it, even without being informed. And maybe that's why it works over there, lo nimnu. Kamash Malon, that the second case, when we're talking about Tuman Tahara, which are not public issues, nevertheless, they still did not desist from interacting, and that shows you that they must have been kind enough to offer the information and explain to them that, according to you, this is Tamei, because we believe it's Tahor, but we know you believe it's Tamei. And therefore, they prevented mishaps happening when they lent to each other because they were generous with the information that they shared between them. And that's the reading of Rashi, which Tosafot already points out is very difficult because it makes an assumption that Beit Shammai thinks things are Tahorim and Beit Hillel thinks things are Tmeim. Or in other words, it seems to be that Beit Hillel is the Chumrah and Beit Shammai is the Kula. And we know from the Mishnayot and Ediyot that there are limited cases where Beit Hillel is the Hachmir. And even in the list of those items that are found in Ediot, only two of them deal with Tuman Tahara. To say because of those two incidents by Tuman Tahara, that Beit Hillel is always the Chumrah and Beit Shammai is the Kula doesn't make sense. It should be just the other way around. It should be that Beit Hillel thinks things are the Tahara and Beit Shammai thinks that they're Tmeim and that Beit Shammai is the Chumrah. And therefore the Baalei Tosafot favors the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Hananel over here, that the Bishlama goes the other way around. Which is Aval Rach Garis Irpcha Bishlama Beit Hillel Lo Nimnu Mi Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel did not desist from taking from Beit Shammai Mitumot to Beit Shammai because the Beit Hillel Torot Ninu. Because the Chumrot of Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel thinks they're Torim. But the other way around, Beit Shammai, why would they take things from Beit Hillel if they think they are Tmeim when Beit Hillel thinks they are Torim? And that way it would be consistent what we know of Beit Hillel is the Chula and Beit Shammai is the Chumrah. The problem with this Girsa is the latter part of the Gemara that says Ma'ume Dahach Mehach. Why is the latter case in the Mishnah more compelling than the earlier case in the Mishnah? Although there are some that leave that out of the Girsa then, based on the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Hananel, nevertheless, the Baalei Tosafot point out, there is a reason to believe that the latter part is more compelling because of the fact that earlier case in the Mishnah with regards to the Arayot, maybe lo asu. Maybe they did not act on their position. They only did it or believed that theoretically. As opposed to the latter part of the Mishnah, which is clear that they acted on those positions. But as Tosafot points out, even if they did not act on their position, there's a big difference between the Arayot and the case of the Tuman Tahara. Because the case of Arayot, if they lo asu, means they didn't act on their position at all. And they did not follow their position, it was just a theoretical position. With regards to Tuman Tahara, where Beit Shammai or the Chumrah, over there in that instance, even if they followed the position of Beit Hillel, they would not have to give up their position, the Chumrah, of their stringencies. And that's because what we saw before. Because someone who sees that the person is stringent might just say he doesn't need this kli, or he doesn't need this stuff. I mean that going l'chumra in that case would not be a violation of the psak being like Beit Hillel. And therefore, you could prove from here that they must have been informing each other about the information, even lo asu, even if they did not act on their own position. Because with regards to Tuman Tahara, even if they didn't follow their own position, they passed like Beit Hillel, nevertheless, they would be machmir for their position where they could, without it being a problem of agudot, And therefore, the only way that could have worked was if they informed each other about this information so that the people of Beit Shammai knew when to be stringent in these situations. And therefore, the second case is a stronger proof text to the fact that Modiluhu, that they informed them about the information, even though it may not be a proof, the fact that they assume that they acted on their own position. And now the Gemara says, Gufa goes back to this statement that we quoted before, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Afal Pi Shenechlaku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, Bitzarot, Modim She'en Mamzer, Ela Mish Isuro Isur Erva, Banushkaret, Man Modim. Who admits to whom over here? Ilam Beit Shammai the Beit Hillel, if you think that Beit Shammai agree with the position of Beit Hillel, Pshita, B'nei Chai V'Lavin, K'sherim Ninhu. Of course, they don't think that what Beit Hillel says is problematic because it's only a chiyuv lav that tzarot erva according to Beit Shammai's position, which is that this woman shouldn't be marrying a third party without chalitza, but even if she doesn't have chalitza, it's just a violation. Lo tia isha demet achutza li ish zar.
And the children are clearly not mamzerim, so then why wouldn't Beit Shammai accept these children that were born of the psak halacha of Beit Hillel?
Ela Beit Hillel, the Beit Shammai, must be that Beit Hillel is agreeing with Beit Shammai.
Meaning that Beit Hillel would accept the women who were tzarot erva from Beit Shammai who had married one of the brothers. That's not plausible because
he gufa chayeve kretoti. This woman, tzarot erva, according to Beit Hillel, is a chiyuv karet. So then what is the information that they're coming to teach you over here? What does it mean, modim, that they agree? So Beit Shammai obviously is agreeing because they think it's a chiyuv lav over here. Beit Hillel already thinks it's a chiyuv karet, so what are they admitting to? So when it says, Olam Beit Shammai to Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai agrees to Beit Hillel, Ulafuke mid Rabbi Akiva, and it comes to exclude the position of Rabbi Akiva Damar, which we're going to see later on in the Masechta, Yesh Mamzer Mechai Ve'Lavin, that a Mamzer can be created from a Chiyuv Lav. According to Beit Shammai, there is a Chiyuv Lav over here, and at Kamash Malon, they're telling you that Ein Mamzer Mechai Ve'Lavin. Even though they think there's only a Chiyuv Lav here by Tzorot Erva, they don't think that produces a Mamzer like Rabbi Akiva. They hold like Beit Hillel, that only Chiyuvei Kretot, or Chiyuvei Mitot Beitin create a Mamzer. And therefore it's Beit Shammai saying that despite the fact that they think there's only a Chiyuv Lav over here, they also believe, like Beit Hillel, that Chiyuvei Kretot are the only thing that creates a Mamzer. And according to their opinion, there wouldn't be Mamzerut. If this Tzaret Erva went out and married a third party without Chalitza, there would not be a problem with Mamzerut here, as we discussed earlier. Tashma, Afa Pisha Nechlegu Beit Shammai Beit Hillel B'Tzarot U'Bachayot U'Beget Yashan U'Besafek Eshet Ish U'Bemegaresh Et Ishto V'Lina Imo B'Pundak B'Kesef U'Beshaveh Kesef B'Puta U'Beshaveh Puta. Even though they argued in all of these major issues, Lo Nimnu Beit Shammai M'Nisa Nashim M'Beit Hillel V'Lo Beit Hillel M'Beit Shammai. They did not desist, they did not withhold from intermarrying between the different factions. Lameitcha, to teach you, shechiba v'reut noagim ze baze, that love and friendship were the way that they treat each other, the way that they engage with each other. The kayem mashenamar, to follow that which is said in the pasuk in Zechariah, ha'emet v'ashalom ehavu, that one should love emet and shalom. In the emet, which is truth, halacha, the din, and shalom, which is peace and friendship and good will between parties, Ehavu, you should love them equally. And therefore, even when you have differences of opinion or you have differences in halacha, the outcome should still be camaraderie and unification. And that's what they did by acting in a civil manner to each other and, quote-unquote, intermarrying between themselves. Now, what are the cases that we are mentioning over here? We'll work backwards through the cases. The last case is the beginning of Kiddushin, which says what's the minimum amount of consideration that has to be given for a woman in order to create Kiddushin. Over there, Beit Hillel believes that is a pruta and shaveh pruta, and that you don't need silver that is pure silver or the standard coinage that's used in the Torah, which is kesef tsuri, the Tyrian coins, and which would be a level of a dinar. They think that a pruta, even the smallest coin, is enough to create or to generate kiddushin, as opposed to Beit Shammai, who thinks that you need that minimum standard of kesef that the Torah demands, which is a dinar kesef, which is the smallest coinage that is still considered to be of the Tyrian coinage, the kesef tsuri, and that's the minimum that you would need in consideration in order to create a marriage. And you could have a nafkamina here where if a person gave a pruta to one woman,
and then another man gave her a dinar afterwards in marriage.
According to Beit Hillel, she's married to the first man that gave the money to her. As according to Beit Shammai, she's married to the second man. And there obviously you could have problems of mamzerut and issues as to which person she is married to. And that is based on how much consideration needs to be given. The next one is a person that megaresh et ishto, divorces his wife, and then lina imo bepundak,
and then they stay beyichud together in a motel, in a bed and breakfast overnight after they've already been divorced. So the question with regards to that is, what do we say about their being together? We have witnesses that they had yichud together. Do we assume those that witnessed her being, them being together be yichud? Heim heim ede yichud, heim heim ede biya. That those same edim that can testify to us that they had yichud together are also considered to be, because of their familiarity to each other and because of the circumstances in which this began, we can assume that not only was there yichud, but there was also biya, and therefore they would require a new get because they are married. Or do we not say, hein hein ede yichud, hein hein ede biya? Yes, we have edim that they're yichud, but we don't know for certain that they had biya, and therefore we don't have to assume that they are remarried now and require a new get. So therefore, according to Beit Hillel, who thinks that the Ede Yichud act as the Ede Biyah, you need a second get over here. So according to Beit Shammai, who thinks that the Ede Yichud are not automatically Ede Biyah, you would not need a second get over here. Get Yashan is a husband that wrote a get, a bill of divorce, and dated it currently to give to his wife. And after some time of living together, he gives her the get. According to Beit Shammai, you can still use the original get. That's not a problem. Because according to Beit Hillel, the fact that they live together in the interim disqualifies the get, and you need a new get. Achayot is a Mishnah that's coming up further on in the Gemara, where you have two brothers that are married to two sisters, and then both of the brothers pass away, and the two women then fall to a third brother or other brothers. At a single time, these two women are then available who are sisters, who are now what's called Achot Zukukato, the sister of the one who is Zakuk the Yibum. They both have Zika the Yibum, and they're sisters that are Achot Zukukato. The law is that they should be chaletz to both of them. They should do chalitza with both of them. Question is, if somebody goes ahead and ignores the halacha and marries one of these women, is the yibum a successful yibum, even though they're pogea b'achot zukut kato? And if different brothers marry these women, yigarshu, they have to have a divorce according to Beit Hillel. Whereas according to Beit Shammai, if they violated the restriction against achot zukut kato and they married them, then once they're married, they can remain married because yibum is allowed. And Pogeya B'Achot Zukukato is not sufficient grounds to have them get divorced afterwards. And Tzarot, which is our mission over here, is whether Tzarot Erava is released without Chalitza or not. Beit Hillel says, yes, no need for Chalitza, because she's an Erava. Whereas Beit Shammai believes that she could have Yibum or Chalitza, but she needs something to be able to release, but also has the Kula that she can have Yibum over here, because she's not Tura, because she's a Tzarat Ha-Erva. So now we went through all these different cases, with the exception of one, which is Safek Eshadish. The reason I did that is because it's a machloket in Rashi himself as to what Safek Eshadish is. Rashi brings down two possibilities. The first possibility is whether this has to do with Miun, a Ktana, a minor, who wants to annul her marriage, which is permitted because she's only married Midirabanan. And if she only has a marriage Midirabanan, it can be annulled through Miun by her rejection of the husband. Question is, can Miun be performed only with an Arusa or even with a Nisua? So according to Beit Shammai, only an Arusa can perform Miun, not an Nisua. If she was fully married and there was a consummation of the marriage, then Miun is no longer available option. As opposed to Beit Hillel, believes that it applies even by Nisuin. And the reason that this Ktana is called a Safek Eshadish is because you always have the possibility that she'll walk out on the marriage. She can annul the marriage at any time, and the fact that she can walk out of the marriage makes her into a Safek Eshadish. That's one possibility that Rashi suggests. Where he brings Lishna Achrina, which is Niresh Chimera, a person who is on their deathbed. This is your will of divorce from today if I die from this illness. So now his illness drags on. What is the status of the woman in the interim? She has a get that's effective from today, only if he dies from this illness. So during that period of time, she's called a Safek Eshadish. And then what is her status? So that the Gemara in Gittin has a machloket Tanaim with regards to that, that Rabbi Yossi Omer Bilato Safek, that any Biya with her is a Safek, Rabbi Omer Bilata Tluya, meaning that they have different opinions with regards to this. And in addition, there's a locha Nalotit Yachedi Molel Piedim, that they should not be secluded together, because then that runs into the problem again. If a divorce is given and then they are mityached afterwards, we saw that machloket between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai with regards to this, which is the same machloket that they had by Migareshet Ishto V'lana Imo Bipundaki. So that's Rashi's second suggestion about what Safek Eshadish is over here. Now, even though Rashi favors his second Lashon, Tosafot says about the Lashon of Chereb Rashi, even though we don't find that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel actually argued there, but they are cholek by Migareshet Ishto V'lana Imo Bipundaki, so it's a similar type of machloket, and if we're assigning it, he says, Lo Nira,
So Tosafot says that doesn't make any sense that a machloket where we don't find a machloket between Beit Hillel and Shammai, but we're assuming there's a machloket because of another incident where they argue, which is Megresh Yishtov Elana Yimal Bepundagi. Well, if that case wasn't mentioned here, that'd be one thing. But it's mentioned in the list over here. So why would you mention Sefek Hesidish, which is all premised on that other machloket, when you're mentioning that other machloket as well? And therefore the Balei Tosafot think that that is not a good explanation. They don't offer an alternative explanation, which means that they seem to probably to favor Rashi's first explanation over here. So now that Braita that we just quoted over here continues with Rabbi Shimon's opinions. This Rabbi Shimon Omer, Nimnu Hein Min HaVadai, Lo Nimnu Min HaSafek. The assumption here, and the way Rashi reads this, is that they stayed away or desisted from engaging with someone who had a Vadai problem over here, a Ishut problem that was clear, but they did not avoid Min HaSafek. And as Rashi says over here, where's the Safek over here? Is a Safek, Kagon Migaresh Belana Yimo Pundugi. Maybe there was a Safek that they got re-engaged or they got remarried. So if there's a Machloket where it has to do something that's Vadai, there they desisted from intermarrying between each other. Whereas if it was a case of Safek, they did intermarry between each other. And the Gemara says about this, if Beit Shammai actually acted on their position, then Rabbi Shimon's position makes sense that they desisted from intermarrying because they had problems. If you think that was all theoretical and they didn't act on their position, then why did they desist from intermarrying? So let's assume, like you think, that they actually acted on their position. So I understand why Beit Hillel didn't marry into Beit Shammai, because according to them, the way Beit Shammai is passing with regards to Tzaret Erva, it's a chiyuv karet, umamzerimim, and the children and offspring are mamzerim. The Beit Hillel, according to Beit Hillel's position. Ela Beit Shammai, amai nimnu mi Beit Hillel. Why would Beit Shammai desist or avoid marrying into Beit Hillel? They are only a chiyuv lav, uksherim ninu, and the offspring are kasher. And even though there are other things in the Braita that Beit Shammai might have wanted to avoid Beit Hillel for, including the dinar, kesef versus pruta for kiddushim, and other issues there, nevertheless, the Balei Tosafot point out, the Reis says that the major focus of the Braita is on the tzarot, and therefore whatever is being said here has to have a reference to the tzarot, because that's the primary context in which this is said. This Tosefta is brought in the context of our Mishnah, and therefore it must be focusing on tzarot, and that must be the primary reason for everything that's mentioned in this Braito. Ka'amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. So the Gemara says, no, the problem here is not the offspring. The woman herself, Beit Shammai believes, is a problem to marry. Yeah, the offspring are ksherim, but the woman herself is restricted according to them. Even though it's an Isur Lav, it's still an Isur Doraita of a Lav. So to over here, they withheld or did not intermarry with Beit Hillel because of the problem of the woman herself. Where it says, Umayshna min avadai di surahu. Why is there a difference in their view as to whether there's a vadai isur here, or safek nami isurahu? Even if you have a safek, it's a safek doraito. If you have a safek doraito, you should go to Chumrah, and why would you then not avoid these women, or not avoid these issues that are b'machloket, just because it's a safek? So Gemara says, lo teima min safek. It's not something that was produced from the safek, ela ema min astam, that if it was a default scenario, they would not avoid those people from Beit Shammai, would not avoid the women of Beit Hillel, and the people of Beit Hillel would not avoid the women of Beit Shammai. Why? Because they would inform them about the information, and they would then desist or not get married to those women. So then what is that coming to teach us? Why does he have to teach us the difference between a safek and a vadai? That they used to treat each other with camaraderie, love, friendship, hainu reisha. That's what the Tanakhama said. So then what's Rabbi Shimon adding for us? The fact that he mentions the difference between Vadai and Safek. Hakamash Malan, Dukula Rabbi Shimoni. The answer is that the whole Braita was authored by Rabbi Shimon, and it's coming to teach us that exact point, that when it came to a Vadai, they used to avoid intermarrying into each other's families that had this problem, according to Beit Shammai or Beit Hillel, each one of vis-a-vis the other. And when it came to Mina Safek, it's not Mina Safek, but Mina Stam, when it was without any information that was disclosed, then they would continue with the shidduch. They wouldn't ask any more questions because they knew that if there was something wrong, the people of Beit Hillel would inform the people of Beit Shammai, or the Beit Shammai people would inform the people of Beit Hillel. So when there was no information disclosed, then they assumed that it was good, and the shidduch could continue, and there was no problem for each party in that shidduch, because they were so close with each other, they had such respect for each other, that they made sure to inform each other if there was a problem. And that is a demonstration of this idea of the love and affection and respect that they had for each other. Be'emet v'shalom ehavu. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines from the bottom of Yud Daled Amud Bet.